Welcome back to my series on morality. My name is Father Cody Williams, and we are in our final part of the introduction. So after today, we move into the practical application of the principles we've been learning. This last part, part 5, is something that's more theological. It's something that puts all the pieces together and lets them be seen in a new light. The topic for today is the dignity of the human person, conscience, and sin. So in this way, what it does is it reminds ourselves that morality is based on people and how they grow, develop, and become good, upstanding people as opposed to a principle or a law. So often we think of morality simply in the terms of right and wrong, actions that we do, things that we do, and not in the terms of what it means for an individual person, how one seeks the good, how one seeks truth, how one seeks to be something for the whole world. And so for that reason, let us dive into the first topic for today, the dignity of the human person. In modern society, we don't talk a lot about the dignity of the human person. We talk about people, we talk about who they are, but the only times we really talk about dignity are when people's rights are violated, or when somebody wants something, so we use the word dignity as a way to show that they are given something special, or maintain their humanity. But in this way, we need to think about dignity in a new way. We need to recognize what dignity means for us and how it surrounds this topic of morality. For a long time, for the vast majority of human history, human dignity was defined by the actions of a person. What you do is who you are. So if you act rightly and morally, you are a good person. If you act poorly or immorally, you are a bad person. So that whatever people see of that person becomes their dignity, not something intrinsic to who they are. The same way we saw dignity in the sense of freedom, as a way of showing our desire, what we need, so that, especially today, we think of our dignity in the sense of being able to be free, to do as we see fit, to be able to live our lives as we want, irrespective of how it affects other people or even ourselves. Therefore, we replace conscience with dignity. In the same way, we also have to see dignity as part of a culture. Today, we see our dignity as humans. Whatever is human has a certain dignity. Regardless of whether we follow this or not, we see everyone who has a certain set of characteristics as human, and every human as accorded a certain right or a certain privilege of being dignified. The Christian Church, however, takes a different approach on this. Instead of seeing our dignity as a set of actions or ways that we interact with the world, Christians see dignity as intrinsic to a human being. Dignity is something given to us by God and cannot be taken away. It allows us to be human, allows us to work in the world, allows us to have our freedom, to have our conscience. Dignity is the center point through which morality makes sense. For if I am a human being, endowed with reason, endowed with freedom, endowed with a quest for good, then I need to conform my life or work my life in such a way that I live out what my dignity entails, namely, to be a good moral person. So in this way, the Christian Church starts with the perspective that dignity is intrinsic to the human person as given by God. So God gives us our dignity. Our dignity, then, is used for several things. The most important one is our own freedom. As a dignified person, that no one can take away my dignity, I am free to be who I meant to be. I am free to live in the world. I am free to interact with things. I am free to do as my conscience directs, which then leads to the second part of it. Our dignity has responsibilities. As a dignified human being, my responsibility is always to seek the good, to seek the true, to seek what brings life to the world. I am used to use my actions, my abilities, my reason, my conscience, all these things to direct me to higher goods, seeking the good for all society. And lastly, my dignity is not an escapism, as though I'm trying to fight the world and fight against things, but as a way to really seek freedom and to seek the good for all people, to conform our lives to good, and hence the whole last four sessions I've led, seeking to find out what is that good. Therefore, summarizing this first topic, our dignity as human beings is something very valuable. And it's something we have to realize again. I think we've lost it. We have gotten so caught up in self-discovery and this idea that dignity is my actions that we forget about who we are, an intrinsic quality. Instead, we try to make who we are, which leads to a loss of problems. It leads to a loss of sense of self. It leads to a disorientation of one's life. And it leads to a lot of mental and psychological problems. Always trying to seek who I am, not realizing who I am. From the idea of the dignity of the human person comes our second concept, which is the conscience. I always laugh at the way media uses conscience as these two figures, an angel and a devil that sits on a person's shoulder. The angel tells them the good thing to do, and the devil tells them the bad thing to do. That's largely how we see our conscience, as a good force and an evil force that directs us in various different directions. Our goal is to comply with the good and fight against the evil, but largely most people choose the evil. I hope we see a grave problem in this. How often do we really feel like our conscience tells us two very different decisions? How often are we really choosing evil? The whole idea that we have in the media of conscience should be so easy for us to make good decisions. Should make it so easy. Why would we choose the evil option? If we knew there's an angel there directing us to the good, why not just go with the good option? That's the problem. So we have to see conscience differently. We can't just see it as a choice of right or wrong, but something different, much like dignity, innate in us. And that's my starting point. Conscience is innate. Everyone has this sense of right or wrong. Where it comes from is a different question. And that's something that psychologists wrestle with and sociologists wrestle with and don't get out as far as we wish. We don't have the language we want. We don't have the conclusions we want. Instead, it seems to be as though conscience is just there. To some extent, it is shaped by our culture. What our parents taught us as good and bad, right and wrong, shape what we think is right and wrong. But that's not entirely true. There are lots of people who fought against common culture, fought against the people of their times, and said, no, this is wrong. The best example of this would be slavery. Many people throughout, especially the north of our country, said slavery is immoral. There's something wrong about this. Even those in the south chose a different path than complying with slavery and its implications. From a Christian perspective, conscience takes a very different form. Conscience is the mind of God. It's the innate quality within us that teaches us what is good. This is where the Christian church is very idealistic. It's one of those places in which we almost stare at it blankly going, really? That's what you teach? But nevertheless, bear with me for a moment. So the conscience is that small voice within us that tells us what is good. It's given to us by the Creator, God Himself, who made us. He breathed His Spirit into us, and by breathing into us, gave us a part of who He is. This part directs us, it guides us, it helps us along the path with the ultimate goal that we would seek what is good and right. That is the goal of conscience. Conscience is supposed to direct our attention, our energy, our minds, our hearts, our souls to what is ultimately good. Therefore, even more idealistically, the church teaches us that we must comply with our conscience. Whatever our conscience tells us, we must do. Not only that, we are morally obliged to follow our conscience, because the assumption is the conscience will lead us to the good, and as long as it leads us to the good, we are obliged to follow it. So, if someone acts on their conscience, even though the event, the action, the end result is bad, they have made a moral decision. I bet you're all thinking, no way. This can't be what we teach. Let me advance it a little further, because that's not the end of it. So, we start out with this idea of conscience, innate to who we are. The conscience is there to direct us to the highest good. But is that always the case? Are we always directed to the highest good? No. I think most of us realize that our consciences aren't what we think they should be. We have lots of issues with them, that lead us to act in various different ways and sometimes even make immoral decisions. So in this way, we have to recognize one other very important principle. We must form our consciences. We must reflect on our actions, recognize what was right and wrong, realize that we have the ability to choose. Our dignity, our freedom, allows us to make choices, and those choices are ours and ours alone. Therefore, as we comply with things in the world, we wrestle with different concepts, we learn from our actions, we realize times in which our conscience might be wrong. If we know that our conscience is wrong, we are morally obliged to not follow it, because we know it's wrong. But as long as we assume our conscience is right, we must follow it, and must always work towards developing it, building it, helping it grow, helping it seek what is truly good, that we may ultimately comply with it. Because think of it this way. If our conscience was formed properly and well, and we knew that, we trusted it, then whatever situation we come upon, whatever problem may occur, we can make quick decisions and know that they're going to be right. That's the beauty of the conscience. If it's formed properly, formed well, and we can trust it, then we know we can make quick, easy decisions and know they're always going to be good. That's our goal. So our last topic for this session is on sin. Nothing summarizes this better than moving into the topic of sin. We started with the dignity of the human person, that we are given intrinsic dignity that allows us to seek the good, to be free in the sense that we choose right and good actions, and that our conscience directs us to those good actions, leading us to ever greater freedom, freedom to make good choices, freedom to seek the good. Ultimately, that doesn't happen, or as often as we wish, which leads to the topic of sin. Sin is a tough one in a series on morality because it doesn't fit like I wish it would. Sin is based on God's law. Whenever we sin, we violate His law, which is essentially what it is. Not necessarily a moral law. Now, God's law is the ultimate moral law, so in effect, as much as we sin, we break the moral law. But there are situations, especially in modern culture, in which we have immoral actions that are not necessarily sinful. And we have sinful actions that are not necessarily immoral. For instance, if God asked me to do something and I said no, that's sinful, but not immoral. Didn't break a moral law. It's harder the other way around, because most of our moral laws are God's law. The few exceptions would be, it's not immoral for me not to attend Mass on Sunday. It is from a church perspective, but not from a societal perspective. If societal laws and God's laws were one and the same, then sin and morality would be the same. And as much as we sin, our actions are immoral. And as much as we are immoral, the actions are sinful. But since that's not where we're at, I wanted to make that distinction. Sin is based on God's law. Breaking God's law means that we have committed sin. Where people get really confused and get caught up with language is the difference between mortal and venial sin. Mortal sin is very specific. It's sin that breaks the relationship with God. It doesn't just mar it or tarnish it, it breaks it. That we've done something so bad, so heinous, that it actually ruptures or divides our intention with God. And so in that way, we have to see it that way. For the vast majority of us, our sins aren't always mortal. Most of the time, we commit lots and lots of what's called venial sins. And for the most of us, we don't really understand mortal sin because we don't feel it. It's not something that we notice the difference. We can't feel the change in our relationship with God. And that comes from a couple different reasons. So if someone's deeply ingrained in the prayer life, deeply seeking God, has advanced in their knowledge and love of God, and really feel His presence in their lives, then when they commit a mortal sin, it's felt. It's realized. It makes sense because they feel the difference in relationship. St. Teresa of Avila, who in her master work, The Interior Castle, writes that a person who achieved the fourth mansion, meaning that God has taken over his work in the soul and guided it to interior meditation, someone who has advanced to this level and falls into mortal sin may get so caught up with it or it becomes such a problem in their lives that they actually leave the castle and never come back. There's a point in the spiritual life in which mortal sin becomes such an issue that it can actually completely rupture someone's relationship with God and even might bring it to an end. This is the damage of mortal sin. Now, mortal sin has three conditions that lead to it, and these three conditions are necessary for sin to be considered mortal. The first one is knowledge of the gravity of the act. We have to know it's mortal, and we have to know what we're doing. If we don't know it's bad, then how are we supposed to be held accountable? In the same way, ignorance is part of the issue that leads from mortal to venial sin. If I just didn't know, how am I held accountable? The second one is full consent to the act. I have to give my consent. When I was in seminary, we wrestled with this question. Can someone give full consent? Are we at a place ever where we're not bound by some sort of emotion, spiritual issue, compliance issues? It can be as simple as addictive behaviors or habits. These things limit our full compliance with the act. Many of us got to the point where we argued that we never have full consent. The more I wrestle with this question and the implications of it, the more I realize we do have full consent. We actually have more consent than we realize. We are far more powerful and more able to fight against our temptations than we like to believe. We would love to believe that the temptations just come and we're compliant to it. We can't really fight against it. But that's not true. Jesus, in his adventure in the desert with the devil, shows us we have a lot more ability to fight the devil, fight against temptation, than we thought. Therefore, we can give full consent to our acts. I can say such things as, I am choosing to do that. I am going to go rob that bank. I'm going to choose not to pray. I'm going to go have sex with that woman. These are things I choose, not things that I just comply with. So I think we need to be more real about our consent with our own actions. We consent far more often than we realize. But there are various things that limit our consent. If we have a habit, habits are hard to break. Therefore, if we're in the midst of a habit, we can say, okay, I'm real with myself. I'm struggling with this habit. How can I give myself more freedom? Where am I truly consenting versus where is the habit taking over? Addictions are much the same. If someone has a mental or physical disorder that prevents them from doing certain things, then therefore they are not fully compliant. Their body just doesn't allow it. This is what it means to have consent. How am I consenting to the actions of my life? The last one is the action has to be grave matter. It can't just be some menial idea. For instance, grave matter would be killing someone, stealing, lying, cheating, all these different things. There's several things that are not grave matter, such as a snide comment, or not greeting someone with the enthusiasm they ought, or being lazy and not really complying with what we ought to. There's lots of places where our sins are just a problem, but not a grave problem. They're not serious in that way. These three conditions are necessary for mortal sin. Knowledge of the gravity of the act, full consent to the act, and the action has to be grave matter. These are necessary for mortal sin. When it's not mortal, which means these three conditions aren't met, then it's venial. They're less in gravity, they mar the relationship, they color it, they taint it. We use words like that to describe it, where it's not truly problematic, but it causes some issues. So most things fit into venial sin, and in that way they change our relationship with God, they harm it, and we just need to ask for forgiveness. I hope that this little purview into moral theology, and namely the theological side of it, focusing on the dignity we have as human beings. We are made in the image and likeness of God, endowed with freedom and gifts, and a responsibility to seek after the good, which leads to our conscience, our guide, the one that helps us to seek what is truly good and right, and, formed well, can lead us to good and moral actions. And then sin. What happens when things go awry? How we affect our relationship with God, what this means on a theological and spiritual level, and how we comply with sin, comply with our habits, and eventually try to work out of it to lead good moral lives. Please stay tuned for next session when we start to put all this stuff into practice.